Well, greetings, brethren. It is nice to be back, and we have had a very eventful, a very hectic, and a very exciting trip, in many ways a very trying one. I'll tell you about it in a few moments. First of all, I want to make one comment. I heard in the morning service a great deal about the many who have left the church. And again in the sermonette this afternoon, and I'd like to clarify that just a little bit. If even one member leaves the church, brethren, that is too many. And I think if a dozen or 100 or even 200 or 300 leave the church, we would begin to call that many. But don't ever get the idea that it is the many who have gone out and the few who are left, because that is absolutely not true. The many are still in. Thank God for that. And comparatively, it is the few who have gone out. And I want to say something about the many who are in the church this afternoon. My message is going to concern them. First, however, I think you'd like to hear a little bit about the trip we had, and I'm not going to try to give you an account of the events because you'll read that in the worldwide news. I think that the first half of the trip has already appeared in print, and the rest of it will, and perhaps the next issue of the worldwide news. But it has been both a very eventful trip, a very trying one, and yet withal, I would say, the most rewarding, the most successful, the most fruitful trip that I have ever taken. You know the story of the good news and the bad news, and I think I should give you the bad news first, and then we'll come to the good news. We departed on, let me see, it was the day of the parade and the Rose Bowl game. Immediately after the New Year's Rose Parade, we had a luncheon in the faculty dining room for some celebrities, and I left from there for the airport. And while the Rose Bowl game was being played, we were flying out across the Pacific Ocean toward Honolulu, spent the night there. Next morning, we traveled on down to Auckland, New Zealand. Of course, we lost a day on the way when we crossed the international date line. So I think it was Monday when we left here. It was Tuesday morning we left Honolulu. That same night we arrived in Auckland, but it was Wednesday night. We got right down to the middle of the week in a hurry. And I believe it was the next day we went out to the SEP summer camp. And somehow at the summer camp I was in one of the counseling rooms. There must have been a draft or something, and I caught a very sore throat. And I think it was later that night, and certainly by the next morning, I had quite a sore throat, and I was quite alarmed because if it went down into pneumonia, that would be quite serious at my age. I'm more afraid right now of something like that than I am of another heart attack. So far as my heart is concerned, I think you all know I'm living on borrowed time, but it seems to hang on about the same way. And I simply have to stop at times, sit down, and no matter what, just say I refuse to go another step until I rest, because it would overdo my heart. And if I started to go on, maybe I'd stop going on for the rest of this life. So I usually am very careful to sit down the minute I feel any trouble coming on in my heart. And as long as I'm very careful about that, I feel God can keep me going for quite a little time yet. The one thing I have been deathly afraid of would be catching a cold going into pneumonia. And I've had to struggle with that this whole trip. Fortunately, God did not let it hurt my voice. And my voice kept up. I was able to keep up with all of the speaking that I had intended to do in every way. And I spoke to practically all of our brethren in New Zealand and then practically all of our brethren in Australia. We even went out to, now I get mixed up down there, whether it's Eastern or Western Australia, but the other side of Australia, or Perth. I'd never been to Perth before. It's a very beautiful city. And actually quite a lot larger city than I had thought it was. It would be considered as one of our major cities if it were in the United States, a city of that population. I think it would be considered larger than Seattle or Kansas City. It's, after all, a fairly good-sized city. At Singapore, they had a special orchestra play a special abbreviated concert for us. It probably lasted about 20 minutes. It was played on old Chinese instruments. I had never seen such instruments in my life. And I'm sure most of you have never seen instruments of that type. And so there was some talk about bringing that orchestra here to play in this auditorium. Now, they are of a caliber that would qualify for performance in this auditorium. They are very professional and very proficient. They happen to have a very professional conductor. And they played various kinds of music, not only Oriental music and old Oriental music, but some of the modern European music, the more classical type, on those instruments. It was quite interesting, and I found that if we would sponsor their coming here, and perhaps they could also play at the Kennedy Center in Washington and perhaps other places, New York, San Francisco, Chicago, the Japanese government would pay two-thirds if we'll pay one-third of the expenses. And I think something may come of that, but there is a Chinese orchestra also possibly coming to play here, so we may still see some of those ancient Oriental instruments. At Hong Kong, we have three members, and with the group of us and so many of our television crew being there, we really had quite a little group. I don't know, was that, maybe that was just last Sabbath, I believe it was. Just last Sabbath, we had quite a service there. And then we went on to Tokyo. We arrived in Tokyo Well, that must have been on Monday night. No, Sunday night. We went down to the newly decorated grill room, which has a new fancy name that I don't remember now. It's all renewed, and had a dinner. I didn't eat anything that should have upset my stomach, but about an hour or two later, I had a very serious stomach trouble, and then I began to throw up. Now, during the trip, I had also been in a draft in Australia and had caught cold, and I had a temperature varying anywhere from normal and 1 or 2 tenths of a degree up to 2 degrees. And 2 degrees of temperature, I consider now at my age, quite serious. And so I've been fighting those things the whole trip. Still, I've managed to carry on everything except that when this hit me in Tokyo, I was confined to bed for the next 2 days, and I had to cancel all engagements in Tokyo. However, many of my Japanese sons, as I call them, came to the hotel to visit me. Others, including Prince Mikasa, sent flowers, and I heard from them, and some very outstanding things were accomplished. One of my Japanese sons is now in control under the Prime Minister of that part of the Japanese budget allocated to giving aid to the developing nations, other smaller nations, just like the United States does. Now, Japan is the second most powerful economic nation in the world, next to the United States. Japan is more powerful than Germany, than England, Britain, than Russia, than any other nation in the world. And in many cases where the Ambassador Foundation might invest a few thousand dollars in some project that is needed in a developing country, the Japanese government will back us with millions of dollars. They already have done that in Kenya, in Africa. Through our foundation, we contributed $35,000 to the establishment of a new university in agriculture and technology. I planned that some 7 or 8 years ago with President Jomo Kenyatta of Kenya. Of course, the whole nation was named after him. The Japanese government put in a total of about $50 million. And the university is now going full bloom. Many new buildings have been built. They're not quite at the standard of the Ambassador College campus in quality and character, but they're new, they're modern, they're clean, and it is quite a university going, and they have about the same student enrollment there that we have on this campus here. And in many ways, this trip was an overwhelming success. So I just thought that you would like to know those things before I get started on what I believe is a very important subject. Brethren, there is one goal that human beings have been striving for the last 6,000 years. I might read a certain psalm that we have had quoted more than once. I think it's the 100 and, isn't it, the 103rd psalm. How good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. You know, the world has been trying to get together in unity ever since Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden about 6,000 years ago. It's been a goal that has been striven for to bring about interracial, international unification. And a one-world government with peace, or some kind of united government. When they couldn't unite the governments of the world, they've tried to form alliances. But, of course, one alliance has always been formed to oppose and usually have war with some other union of nations or alliance or allied nations. Why is it that in the world they have never succeeded in a universal government? There has always been division. One thing that I noticed on this trip, I noticed it in New Zealand, I noticed it in Australia. For example, in Australia, I met a man who had the same position as we in this country. We'd call it governor of the state. And, of course, we heard talk about the opposition and the opposing party. Everywhere there's the opposing party. Here in the United States, we have a Republican in the presidency and a Republican Senate. But there's the opposing party, the Democrats. Now they're doing everything to move heaven and earth, if they can, to oust President Reagan and to get complete control of the Senate. It's one against the other. They cannot have unification. Now, about 6 months ago, it doesn't seem that long, but it really has been now, over 6 months ago, just about that, we had Dr. von Habsburg here, and he spoke from this platform, visited my office and my home. He is striving for the unification of Europe into a one nation again. And they're having a terrible time to accomplish it. And it's a little discouraging to some of those working for it at the present time. Bible prophecy says they're going to accomplish it. And something is going to happen to suddenly just change the course of events in Europe and bring that about. And it will happen. But now why? Why is it that men cannot get together? Why must there always be division? Why must there always be competition and strife? And yet, brethren, I wonder if you realize that in the last half century, the last half of this 20th century, God's church has accomplished what the governments of this world have striven for 6,000 years to do and could never accomplish. God's church has accomplished it. For the first time in 6,000 years, it has been accomplished. A united government. And there is united government in this church. And I'm going to touch on one reason why some have left. And why we're not going to have as many leaving the church from now on as we've had in the past. There is a reason for these things. But a goal has been achieved, and I want you to understand it, by this church during the second half of the 20th century that all humanity has striven to achieve and never could before. And that is a unified government. I notice now that wherever I go, and I've just been on a trip visiting brethren in I met our minister and his wife in Honolulu, but otherwise I met brethren in New Zealand, both those from the north and the southern part of New Zealand, spoke in Auckland and also in Wellington. And with some telephone hookups, we reached practically all the membership in New Zealand. And then I spoke I never can remember the names of certain cities. Well, in the north and the south, and then on the other side of the whole continent. But there were telephone hookups just like we have here. I spoke to practically the entire membership in Australia. Now, there, we have had trouble in the past, and we're not having trouble today, and we're having unity. Ministers come here now, and they say that 5-6 years ago, there was contention, there was disputing, there was division, and there was trouble here at headquarters. Now, they say, oh, it is so different today. Now, today we find harmony, we find unity, we find a spirit of love and a spirit of peace, a spirit of joy and happiness, a togetherness. And they say it is so different, so refreshing. What has happened? I wonder if you realize, brethren, and there's a great lesson for us in what has happened. But whether I go to Black Africa, or to the Philippines, or to South America, or to Europe, to Australia, New Zealand, or to Malaysia. And incidentally, I spoke to most all of our brethren in Malaysia and Singapore on this trip. And wherever I go, there I find the same spirit. And you can tell a Church of God member almost immediately. There's something different about a member of this church. And you can tell a difference. They're different from Seventh-day Adventist members. There is a different attitude, a different spirit than you find in Baptists or in Methodists or in Catholics. There is a spirit that is the same regardless of race, regardless of nationality or country or location in the earth. It is all the same. Why? What is the difference? Why has God's church, headed by Jesus Christ, succeeded where the world, who has rejected God and who has really rejected the real Christ, why have they failed? There is no unification. Taken even in religion, the world is divided into many, many different religions. And the largest of all of them is the one that is so-called Christianity, or it's often called today traditional Christianity. And it is the largest of the religions in the world. And yet it is divided into hundreds of denominations and sects, each one having certain differences of belief and practice, and to a more or lesser extent competitive against others. And they don't agree. They don't associate one with the other. Each have their own spirit and attitude. But there is no unification. They are divided, and there's always the opposition. Why? Now, once again, you know, I've been accused of always going back to those two trees. Yesterday afternoon, it was almost sundown, and I got the idea that I'd like to have a couple of big illustrations up to show you today. So I took it up with some of our editorial people and the artist division. And so they whipped together something real hastily for me that you find up here this afternoon. I have to get back to the beginning once again to explain some of this to you. Not only to explain God's purpose, to explain why we are coming to unity and one government that is unified, and in the world there's always opposition. Had the first man, Adam, taken of the tree of life, there might have been the same unity that we have in the church today in all facets of society in the world, because it might have become God's world. Now, the tree of life, I think the world has been more in all of so-called Christian religion has been somewhat conscious of the two trees mentioned in the second chapter of Genesis. But you hear very little about the tree of life. It was, is it a year and a half ago? It's quite a little more than a year ago now. I was in South Africa. And down there they were asking me, we were in the home of Dr. I don't know why I can't think of names. Our leader and pastor down there, and practically all the ministers and their wives from Southern California, South Africa, were there. And they gathered around me and they asked me, well, what about the tree of life? And what would have happened if Adam had taken of that tree? And you know, we never discussed very much the tree of life. We discussed the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, while I was at camp in Australia, some children, and they were the children of some of our ministers or grandchildren, and they were anywhere from 3 or 4 up to 6 or 7 years of age, just children. I'm not talking now about the youth or the campers or about the others there, but just the children that happened to be there. And they had produced a large chart for me with a drawing of a tree. There was the trunk and then a lot of bushes around it, and they had the Ten Commandments on the leaves for the tree of life. Well, that gave me an idea, so I went a little further in elaborating on it. Now, I see at my right is a chart of the tree of life. And if you can hear as I look at it, the root of that tree, from which it gathers all of its life and everything comes from the root, is God. Then the main trunk of the tree is the Spirit of God. And above, on one side, are 4 main branches off of that trunk. The 4 main branches are the first 4 of the 10 commandments, and they express love toward God. Then there are 6 other major branches, not quite so large, because they aren't really not as important as those first 4. And they denote love toward fellow man. The last 6 of the 10 commandments. So from God flows life in the form of the Holy Spirit that is injected into those who take this tree. And with life comes the knowledge of the way of life of good and evil. Love toward God and love toward neighbor. Then the very many other branches are all of the other things that come under love toward God and love toward neighbor. In other words, other ways that you love God and that you love neighbor. Then it comes out to the branches and the final fruit. And the fruit born, you'll see, is, well, I can't read it all from here, but it is love and joy and peace and happiness and accomplishment, unity and togetherness. And all of those things are the fruit. Now, if Adam had taken of that fruit, he would have taken what came from the root and up through the trunk of the tree. He would have had the spirit or the life of God. He would have had then the way of God and the spirit of God to give him the knowledge of that way, to give him the love to fulfill that way, to give him the power to live that way, and then to produce the fruit of peace and joy and happiness and of every kind of abundance and everything that mankind could want. Now, on the other hand, there was another tree, and Adam had to make a choice. I can't see it very well from here, and I was just reminded before I came out, this was put together very hastily, and I think one mistake was made. That looked like a dead tree, and in fact it is the tree of death. But actually, that tree appeared very beautiful to Mother Eve. It's when she saw that it was so beautiful and good for food and desired to make one wise that she took of it. But the root of that tree is Satan. And the spirit of Satan coming up through the trunk. And then the various ways that it leads to are the ways of competition, of vanity, exalting the self, even above God, of competition, of strife, of envy, of jealousy, of bitterness, as those who attended the morning service heard in the sermon this morning. The way of opposition, of disharmony and disunity in every way. And that ends in death. The one tree was the tree of life, the other is the tree of death. One is the way of God, the other is the way of Satan. I think perhaps we can even improve on these drawings yet, and we can have something that can be printed and put in books that'll help illustrate that whole thing. It's the very foundation of the way life began and has continued on this earth. Now, the first man that God created, now God had first produced beings that were made perfect so far as their creation was concerned. There was the super archangel Lucifer. He was placed over ordinary angels that were placed on this earth. God set a throne on this earth for government. And he put this super archangel Lucifer on that throne to rule the earth. He's still on that throne, by the way. And he still is ruling this world. And that's what most people don't even realize, because Satan is an archangel. He is therefore a spirit being. He is invisible. He cannot be seen. He cannot be heard, felt, smelled, tasted. And so, the so-called scientists, and science, by the way, would better be called fiction, if you really understand, because there's so much science doesn't even know and doesn't dream, you know. But they know nothing of spirit or spirit beings. But he's still there on that throne to this day. Now, he had been perfect from the day God created him until iniquity was found in him. But as you will read in my book, The Incredible Human Potential, and many other writings, that God made him a free moral agent with a mind that still could make his own decisions. If God had made him so he could not do wrong, that he could not disobey, that he could not choose any other way but God's way of life, which is love and peace and joy and happiness, that he would have been nothing more than a brainless machine. But even machines have a certain kind of a brain today. You may not realize it, and yet most of you may realize it. Most automobiles today are pretty much made by robots. And that are machines that almost have a brain. They work up to a certain extent, but it's all mechanical and they only work the way they are set to work. But they don't think. They don't make decisions. They can't work any other way but just the way they're set to work. And they're a machine. There's no personality there. And that's the way it would have been if God had made angels so they could not sin. Angels are made so they can sin. They've been made to understand the consequences of sin, to understand that sin is wrong, but they've been allowed to reason that perhaps it isn't wrong after all, if they want to begin to reason along that line. And that's precisely what Lucifer did and led all of his angels under him to do. And God finally came to realize that no one but God himself could be relied on to have free moral agency, and who had the power of deciding otherwise and the power of doing wrong and going the other way, but who would have the character to never do that, but to always live the right way, the way that would produce happiness and peace and joy and abundance and production and everything good. And so, I think you might call the creation of angels and their experience an experiment. Now, God was not experimenting any further when he made humanity. Angels were given immortality and immortal life with the opportunity of turning the wrong way. He made man out of matter, which was necessary so that if they turned the wrong way, they could be destroyed as if they had never been in the first place. They wouldn't have to go on suffering. The most unhappy, the most wretched personality or being in all the universe is Satan the devil. He is suffering more than any personality that has ever existed. His suffering is mental and spiritual, and it's far worse than physical suffering. It's far worse than pain that can come physically. He suffers bitterness, resentment, hatred, anger, rebellion. And that cannot make one happy. It makes him miserable and unhappy. And he doesn't know how to get out from under it. And he never shall. He'll have to go on living through all eternity in that unhappy situation. So God made man so that he had to develop the character so that he would not sin before he could have immortality. That's why Adam had to make the choice. And those two trees represented that choice. Now, Adam took the wrong tree. And I've explained so many times how God then shut up that tree entirely from mankind until Jesus Christ, the second Adam, should come. It's just like blocking off this whole thing. Man had no access to the Spirit of God, to God through His Spirit. Now, God made man so he could have access to God through the Spirit of God by putting a spirit, a human spirit, in man. Man himself is wholly physical and material. But the spirit of man, a human spirit, is put in him. It is not the man. It is no part of the man. It is just something in the man that works with the brain in the man, that empowers the brain with intellect, empowers the brain to think, to reason, to decide, to plan, to design, and to do some of the things even that God and only God can do. But man rejected that, and then God closed that tree until Jesus Christ would come as the second Adam. And when Jesus Christ came, he came to open that tree of life all over again. Now, in the meantime, this world has gone along. And I've shown you, brethren, in so many sermons recently and so many articles, how the tree of life has been closed to the world, and only those that are first chosen and drawn by God Himself can even come to Christ the second Adam. And it's only through Christ the second Adam, who is the Son of God, that the tree of life may be opened to anyone today whatsoever. Now, to one who is a real Christian, one who through Christ has come to God, the tree of life is opened. And they may take of this Spirit of God, and God's Spirit will come into them to join with, cohabit with, the human spirit. And that joins them to God.